Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Center of Western North Carolina would like to welcome you to this episode of our podcast, brought to you by BehaviorTherapist.com. Each episode presents news and interviews pertaining to the cognitive behavioral therapies and evidence-based psychotherapy, containing content for consumers and professionals alike. In this episode, Dr. Irving Kirsch on his analyses of clinical trials of antidepressants. Before introducing Dr. Kirsch, I'd like to request that you visit http://behaviortherapist.podbean.com. At that location, you can enjoy the resources that support the podcast and can also post questions and comments about each episode. Please also consider making a donation via the PayPal link at that same location to help defray costs associated with the podcast. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank those of you who have made such donations. We really appreciate that. On to Dr. Kirsch. Dr. Kirsch is a professor of psychology at the University of Hull, United Kingdom, and professor emeritus at the University of Connecticut in the U.S. Dr. Kirsch is noted for his research on placebo effects, antidepressants, expectancy, and hypnosis. He is the originator of response expectancy theory, and his analyses of clinical trials of antidepressants have influenced official treatment guidelines in the United Kingdom. Dr. Kirsch, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Can you give us a brief overview of the current controversy with respect to antidepressants and whether they're effective, and generally what's this issue about?
There have been a number of studies lately, including ones that I've done, mostly meta-analyses of the clinical trial data. And what these studies show are that for most patients, I'd say about 90% of depressed patients, the effects of antidepressants compared to placebo are negligible. And sometimes when you aggregate them, they can be statistically significant, but they're not clinically meaningful.
How did you first get interested in this line of research?
Well, I've always been interested in the placebo effect. Initially, I didn't have any particular interest in antidepressants, but I did want to look and see where there are placebo effects. It made sense to me that there ought to be placebo effects in the treatment of depression, and so I started looking for clinical trials in which people had been given placebos, and clinical trials in which people had been given no treatment at all, put on a waiting list in order to be able to see what the size of the effect of giving someone a placebo is by subtracting out the change that might have occurred without doing anything. As I said, I wasn't interested in antidepressants per se at that point, but the trials that we found, of course, were trials in which the main purpose was not to test the placebo effect, but was to examine antidepressants, to test the effect of these antidepressants. So we had data on the antidepressants, we had data on the placebo, we got trials in which there had been waitlist or no treatment controls, and found that there was indeed a substantial placebo effect in the treatment of depression, much, much greater than what happens if you just wait for spontaneous change without giving any treatment at all. But what surprised us the first time that I saw these data that we had collected and analyzed, what surprised me and my colleague, Guy Saperstein, was how small the effect of the drug was. That is, once you took out the placebo effect, what was left over was pretty small for something that had been touted as a miracle drug that had revolutionized the treatment of depression. So that led me to begin to shift my focus into, my reaction was, well, wait a second, what's going on? There ought to be a much bigger drug effect. That started a controversy that led me to investigate the effects of antidepressants more closely.
Of course, you've already started to tell us a little bit about this, but I wonder if you could tell us, you know, kind of the story of how your research progressed from there.
Well, we published that first article. It was published under the title Looking at Prozac and Hearing Placebo. We published that, and of course, it turned out to be very controversial. People said, well, we know antidepressants work. There have been so many studies of antidepressant medication. You must have looked at only a subset of the studies. If you'd looked at a broader range, you would have found that they work much better than your data seemed to show. And in the midst of that controversy, I received a message from Tom Moore in Washington, and he said he enjoyed the article and was appreciative of the controversy, and he had an idea for how to respond next. And he said, you know, why don't you redo your analysis with a completely different set of data and using, in fact, a privileged set of data. He suggested going to the FDA, using the Freedom of Information Act, getting from the FDA the data from the clinical trials that the drug companies had sponsored in the process of seeking approval for their medications, and analyzing those data in the same way we had with the published trials that we had found through our computer search, and see if we came up with the same results. And I thought that was a marvelous idea. And I said yes, and I suggested that we work on it together. And Tom actually is the one who went to the FDA, got the files from the FDA, made copies of them, sent them down to my colleagues and myself. We analyzed them together. We actually analyzed them separately and then compared analyses to make sure that we hadn't made any mistakes, and found out that not only were our conclusions right when we looked at this broader and privileged set of data, but in fact, if anything, we had overestimated the drug effect in our first analysis, underestimated the placebo effect, and the size of the drug effect, once you subtracted out the response to placebo, was very small, vanishingly small.
Just so we're clear, the conclusions that we're drawing, or that we were suggesting from your research, are that antidepressants don't beat placebo. Is that correct?
Well, they do beat it statistically. If you aggregate all of the studies together, and one of the advantages we had going to the FDA data was that we had the studies that the drug companies had not published, which were largely the studies that show the worst effect for the drugs. When we aggregated all the studies together, there was a statistically significant difference between drug and placebo, but it was a very small difference in clinical terms. It was less than 3 points on the Hamilton Depression Inventory, the most commonly used measure of depression. It was, in fact, 2 points, or 1.8 points, the average difference between drug and placebo, to be exact. To put that into perspective, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, which is the organization that establishes treatment guidelines for the National Health Service here in the UK, have established a 3-point difference between drug and placebo as a cutoff for clinical significance. Even that is a very small difference. The Hamilton scale can go from 0 to 51 points, and you can get a 6-point difference in score just by having changes in sleep patterns with no other changes in symptoms at all. So it's a very liberal criterion for clinical significance, and the drug-placebo difference that we found was far from meeting it. As I said, it was 1.8 points different on this 51-point scale. Statistically significant because there were a large number of subjects when you aggregate the clinical trials together, but in terms of anyone's life and well-being, was meaningless.
Do these findings hold up across severity levels with depression? So in other words, this would also be true, these findings, even in severely depressed patients? The kinds of effects?
So here's what we found with that, and that's been replicated in a more recent meta-analysis on a completely independent data set that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association this year in 2010, and found virtually identical results to those that we found. You do get an increasing separation as depression is more severe, but it's still not clinically significant except for this very small minority of the most extremely depressed. There's virtually no difference at all between drug and placebo with mild depression, moderate depression, severe depression, and even for most people with very severe depression, which is the most severe category in the American Psychiatric Association classification system. It's only at the very end of the extreme, very severe category, the extreme end of it, that you start getting a separation that's more than 3 points difference between drug and placebo on the Hamilton Depression Scale. And it's from that that we're able to derive the conclusion that for 90% of patients, including most of those with very severe depression, the difference just is not clinically significant.
What kind of criticisms have you heard from others about your conclusions here? And I'm also curious what your responses might be to those criticisms.
Yeah, one criticism is that maybe that was raised early on was that maybe the people we were looking at weren't severely depressed enough, and if they were more severely depressed, you would have found a difference. And that's what led us to do our last analysis, where we looked at severity, and we found that you don't get much of a difference, even with for most people with very severe depression. Another criticism that has been raised is, well, clinical trials are different than the real world, and the nature of the patients who are volunteering for these trials aren't the same as most of the patients that you see in clinical practice. I have two responses to that. One response is to look at a particular clinical trial that tried to emulate clinical practice as closely as possible. They dropped a lot of the exclusion criteria, which leads people to get dropped from clinical trials. In standard clinical trials, they didn't advertise for participants. Instead, they just asked for referrals from practitioners, psychiatrists, GPs. They didn't include a placebo control group. They tried to make it as much as possible to have the same kind of population that you would see, that you would be treating in clinical practice and using the same kinds of methods and instructions. They also did things like, well, if a person didn't get better on one drug, they would switch to another drug, and if they didn't get better on the second, they would switch to a third, and if they didn't get better on the third, they'd switch to a fourth. This is called the STAR-D trial, and this was going to be the trial that really showed what the response is to antidepressants in a typical clinical population, and the results are a spectacular disappointment. They're a spectacular disappointment. If anything, they show less of a response to antidepressants than we found in our analysis of the clinical trials submitted by the drug company to the FDA, and especially disappointing when you looked at long-term follow-up, one-year follow-up with these patients. 90% had dropped out of the trial or had become depressed again. The relapse rate was just incredibly, incredibly high. Putting all of that together, what it suggests to me is, yeah, there are differences between the clinical trials as done by the drug companies and clinical practice as it happens in everyday life, but those differences are geared to magnify the difference between drug and placebo, not to minimize it. So if anything, what we are finding is, again, an exaggeration of the drug effect, and even with that, we get a drug effect that's trivial and clinically not significant.
And are the conclusions that we're talking about here true for every class of antidepressants?
Yes. There is no substantial difference in effectiveness between one antidepressant and another, or one class of antidepressant and another. And the most spectacular example of that is the case of SSRIs, which are the most typically used antidepressants these days, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and a drug that is not very well known, but has been approved in France for the treatment of depression. Its name is tianeptine. It's an SSRE, a selective serotonin reuptake enhancer. Instead of inhibiting the reuptake of serotonin, it enhances the reuptake of serotonin. Chemically, it has the exact opposite effect on the brain that SSRIs have. So if SSRIs are effective for chemical reasons, giving patients SSRIs ought to make them worse. In fact, SSREs have the exact same therapeutic effect as SSRIs. If you're using the standard criteria of 50% improvement in symptoms, you get with SSRIs 60% of people of depressed patients responding, getting better by that criterion. In head-to-head comparisons, you get the exact same response rate, about 60%, when you give patients SSRIs.
Why do you think, given all that you've been talking about here, that the belief, you know, in the effectiveness of antidepressants is so widespread?
Well, there are a couple of reasons for that. One reason is that when antidepressants were discovered, clinical trials with placebo controls were not the norm. We didn't have the same kind of rigid formal methodology that we have now. We judge things on the basis of clinical impressions. Second reason is that when you give people antidepressants of any kind, they do get better. The difference in depression from before treatment to after treatment is substantial. It's clinically meaningful. The problem is not that there isn't a response to antidepressants. The problem is that there is a substantial clinical response to placebos, and the difference between the response to the placebo and the response to the antidepressant is not very great. So a physician is treating patients. The physician doesn't prescribe placebos. It's not a clinical trial. It's clinical practice. Prescribes an antidepressant. The patient gets better. The clinician has no way of knowing whether the result is due to a placebo effect or a chemical effect, and is naturally likely to assume that it's the chemicals in the medication that he or she has prescribed that has produced the improvement. So that's another reason. The third reason, and perhaps this is the most important reason of all for the widespread belief in the effectiveness of antidepressant medication, despite the data that the drug companies themselves produced in getting the medications approved, is the fact that a good portion of the data were kept hidden. We found, and others have found, that about 40% of the clinical trials sponsored by the pharmaceutical companies for antidepressant drugs just have never been published. They were withheld from publication. And the only way we were able to get them was through the Freedom of Information Act with the FDA. That means anyone who didn't do what we did, and very few people have used the Freedom of Information Act to get these data, short of using that, researchers who were doing summaries of the researchers, physicians, anyone who wanted to find out, would only be seeing the data that were more favorable to the drug. And, of course, they would then be led to overestimate the drug effect because they weren't seeing all of the data.
You've mentioned the placebo effect as maybe being the active ingredient here to a large degree. Can you talk to us a little bit about what placebos are exactly, as I know that's been a line of research you've pursued for some time?
Well, placebos, of course, in the narrowest and sense, are physical procedures or substances that in which the procedure, the substance, is in physically inert. It doesn't produce the physically or chemically the outcomes that the drug is supposed to produce. So that if it has any effect, the effect is going to be a psychological effect produced by the belief that one is taking a medication, the belief that one is getting a particular treatment, and the belief that that treatment is efficacious. It's typically used in clinical trials to parcel out the effect of the psychological effects of getting treated from the chemical effects of the treatment that you are using. In drug trials, it can also be done with other physical procedures like surgery, in which case you have sham surgery. You open the patient up, you close the patient back up again, but you don't do the surgical intervention, and that would be placebo surgery, and that's been done a number of times in clinical trials as well. What you get when you do these studies are placebo effects. That is, for many conditions, the placebo will have an effect, even though there's nothing chemically, nothing physical that's causing the effect. It's a psychologically produced effect. It's not true across all conditions, and depression, anxiety are areas in which you get very strong placebo effects, get somewhat weaker but still pretty strong effects on pain, and there are some conditions in which you wouldn't get any placebo effects at all.
Do you have any perspective on what will happen here in terms of, you know, actual clinical practice? Do you think you know, clinicians will accept or ignore your data here or your conclusions?
Well, change comes slowly. I was heartened by a poll that was taken in the UK, in which 44% of physicians who were polled said that on the basis of these data, they would consider altering their prescription habits and looking for alternatives to drugs in the treatment of depression. It's my hope that little by little there will be change and people will be looking more for non-drug alternatives to the treatment of depression. These exist, and in some cases they've been shown to be, particularly in the case of cognitive behavioral therapy, they've been shown to be, in the long term, more efficacious than drug treatment.
In fact, that was going to be my next question, is what alternatives would you suggest? And I take it that cognitive behavioral therapy would be one of those alternatives. Are there any others that you would suggest? Or?
Yeah, physical exercise is another alternative that has been studied. The results of the studies that have been done suggest effects are as great as those for antidepressant drugs, which means just slightly better than what you would get with a placebo, but without the side effect risks that come with the drugs. In fact, the side effects of physical exercise are generally things that are sought after, and we would recommend physical exercise to people even if they're not depressed. So even if it's producing a placebo effect, it's producing a much, it's doing so with a much better side effect profile. The data seem consistent on it. However, it hasn't been studied as much as drugs, certainly, or CBT and a couple of other forms of psychotherapy. So there does need to be more studies of physical exercise in the treatment of depression. The best data at this point that we have is data on CBT and the treatment of depression. And what I think the most impressive study is a long-term follow-up study in which over a six-year period, most patients who had gotten 10 sessions of CBT, these are depressed patients who had been medicated, taken off of medication, given 10 sessions of CBT 6 years later, most of them were still depression-free, whereas those who had just gotten clinical management, the same number of hours of meeting with a psychiatrist, but without the specific components of CBT, 90% of them had relapsed.
And it's okay if you don't know this off the top of your head, but I'm just curious, do you know the title of that study or the authors on that study?
Yeah, the author is Fava, F-A-V-A, Giovanni Fava. He's at the University of Bologna in Italy. He reported the first study, then a four-year follow-up, and then a six-year follow-up. And the design was taking patients who had been depressed, had responded to drug treatment. They were then tapered from the drugs, taken off the drug medication, and half were assigned to get these 10 sessions of CBT and half clinical management with everything except the specific components of CBT. At 4 years, there was 80% relapse in the drug-only condition, about 25% in the CBT condition. At 6 years, drug condition relapse had gone up to 90%, and the CBT condition, the relapse rate was about 40%.
Wow, that's very impressive.
They're very impressive data.
For folks who are interested in reading some more about this, now I know you just published it, which I read cover to cover in one sitting. I thought it was just fascinating, actually. And I think the title is The Emperor's New Drug. Is that the title of your book?
That's right, The Emperor's New Drug, subtitled Exploding the Antidepressant Myth. It's published in the U.S. by Basic Books. It's published in the U.K. By the Bodley Head, which is a division of Random House. And thank you for the kind words about it.
Oh, and they're very genuine. I highly recommend that to our listeners. Are there any other recommended readings that you would suggest for folks who are interested in this area?
Yeah, it depends whether the interest is a professional interest or a personal interest. If it's a personal interest in terms of, this I would recommend to everybody, actually, is the book by David Burns, Feeling Good is the title of it. It's a self-help book, It's different from most self-help books in that it has been tested in clinical trials, along with another book by Lewinson and his colleagues. That one's called Control Your Depression. They're both actually very good books. They've both been tested in clinical trials, mostly with moderately depressed patients, have been shown to have nice, strong effects. Patients just work through the books. When I was practicing as a psychotherapist, I used to use feeling good as an adjunct to treatment. And when I was working with depressed patients, I would sometimes have them get the book and work through it in addition as homework assignments between therapy sessions. So it can be used in that way by a professional. It can be used by a person who is trying to cope with depression as an adjunct to whatever else they are doing, and I recommend them very highly.
And what about for professionals? Do you have any recommendations there?
Well, there are. One of the things I've done with the book, even though the book is written for a intended for a wide popular audience, I still insisted on annotating it substantially, so it's well referenced, and there's pages of at the end of source material. There are, of course, the meta-analyses that I did that led me to write the book, and the original analyses themselves are one thing that can be read. There's the replication and extension that was published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, in 2010. The citation for that's also in the book. There are the meta-analyses and summary data of the clinical trials with tianeptine, the SSRE, and the comparisons of tianeptine with both SSRIs and tricyclic medications, and showing head-to-head comparisons, absolutely equivalent results. STAR-D trials, especially those looking at relapse. And there's an excellent article in the Journal of Contemporary Psychotherapy, 2009, written by John Boren, Alan Leventhal, and Ed Pigott, P-I-G-O-T-T, summarizing the follow-up data on the STAR-D trial, and the clearest place to see the figures that indicate just how terribly high the relapse rate was when antidepressants were prescribed in very much a clinical kind of setting, using the kinds of things that would make it as representative as possible of clinical practice.
Well, Dr. Kirsch, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today about this.
It's my pleasure.
Tune in next time when we speak with Dr. Donna Sudak about combining cognitive behavioral therapy with medication. Also looking ahead, we'll be speaking with Dr. Alan Poling, Joe Lang, and Teresa McKeon. Again, please consider visiting us at http://behaviortherapist.podbean.com. Thank you, and we look forward to next time.